Is the Constitution the safeguard of our liberties? If so, how can courts keep using it to generate jarring outcomes that seem to make the power of the central government bigger and bigger, and the scope for states' and citizens' liberties smaller and smaller? That's my question. So hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And we're going to explore this conundrum on today's episode of Independent Conversations. Thankfully, we've got a real expert with us today to help sort this out, William J. Watkins, Jr. Welcome, Bill.
Good to see you as always, Graham.
Thank you so much for joining us. So you have a long affiliation with Independent as a research fellow, and of course, also a lifetime of experience in the law, prosecutor, defense attorney, constitutional scholar. And now you've written this incredible book called The Independent Guide to the Constitution, subtitled Original Intentions, Modern Inventions. And I'm holding up the cover here in my hand, a little easier to hold it this way so everybody can see what it looks like. It's also on the shelf behind me, just as a reminder. So your book covers every part of the constitutional document and shows where it's become distorted and even offers solutions. And your main point seems to be that the document doesn't belong to lawyers and scholars, but to the people. What do you mean by that, Bill?
Well, this is what I mean. Essentially, the Constitution was ratified by popular conventions of the people of the several states. It was the people who had to give a yay or a nay through specially chosen representatives in these conventions to exercise ultimate sovereignty. It's the people's fundamental law. Today, we've really forgotten that. It's really the judge's law, and we have all these esoteric arguments about constitutional provisions when, frankly, the people should be able to understand their fundamental law, protect it, and live by it. And that's been taken from them, and I try to do my part to restore that to them, where they can look up any constitutional provision, see the history, see what's gone wrong, and maybe what we can do about it in the future.
By the way, before we go on, did I mention that the book is available in our online store at independent.org or on Amazon and other book retailers? Just as a reminder to our friends who are with us. So here's a thing that has always kind of given me pause, and I have a feeling it fits right in with your analysis, Bill. But I was looking through the text of the Constitution today, and I often keep this one with me because it's small and handy. This is the one published by the Commission on the Bicentennial, so I've had this for a long time. Looking through the Constitution, for example, in Article 2, Section 3, talks about treason against the United States shall consist in adhering to their enemies. And I was thinking to myself, which they are they talking about? Well, it's the United States written in the document as a plural noun, not a singular noun. Similarly, in the 13th Amendment, slavery shall not exist in the United States or in any place subject to their jurisdiction. But nowadays, everybody treats the term United States as a singular noun. Like, for example, you hear diplomats say, the United States is ready to help its allies. But according to the writers of the constitutional text, they would never have said it that way. What does this change in diction signify, do you think, Bill?
Well, essentially, you could argue that the change from the United States are to the United States is marks a whole new era of government, of a unitary state. You know, Graham, we were not supposed to be a unitary centralized state such as England, France, you name the European country. Really, to me, the core of American exceptionalism is we were different. We were a federation of states where, granted, we needed a central government or a general government, as the framers called it, to exercise certain powers that could only be effectively wielded on a national scale, such as over foreign trade, war, peace, interstate commerce, that type thing. But once you get past that, it was the clear intent of the framers that the states would govern themselves and be as sovereign nations with regard to their laws for their domestic concerns. And not only the diction, but in practice, we've lost that. And that's a great loss to our country.
It does seem like just a way of speaking is kind of a tip-off to some major mental shift. You know, and I'm wondering, I haven't read enough history to know popular culture, when people started referring to the United States as a singular unitary noun rather than a plural aggregate. I'm guessing that it had something to do with the early 20th century progressive movement. Do you think I'm right about that guess?
Yeah, that's not a bad guess. You know, Bob Higgs, obviously in Crisis and Leviathan, a great book that the Independent Institute has, pretty much places the start of our problems at the beginning of the progressive era in the 1890s going forward in the early 1900s. Just as you indicated, I think that's a very defensible position. Higgs is a great scholar. You could even back it up a little bit to the 1860s. And as a result of the war, there was definite centralization in the federal government. And you could see that as perhaps a precursor as well.
Yeah, it just seems to me that the way we talk about our country reflects even kind of unwittingly how we think about what our country is. And it becomes more obvious in some ways to foreigners, you know, who have different languages, like I've studied French some. And in French, you couldn't possibly say the United States is. Even today, the French diplomats say the United States are when they're speaking French. And so something has really shifted. We just think of our country as just one big whole. And that seems to be kind of a loss.
No, it definitely is a loss. I mean, you think about it, where if we use the United States is in our language as well as our political thought, we essentially have the turmoil that we do today of you have to have one answer to every policy question.
Right. And you seem to be saying repeatedly throughout your manuscript that many hot button issues could actually be cooled down if we availed ourselves of our constitutional structure, which is states in a partnership rather than states subject to the center.
No, that is a big theme of this book, is if we're going to live together in peace, and let's face it, unfortunately, we've seen more political violence in the last decade or so, especially the last couple of years. We've seen just the lack of civil discourse among the political parties and individual citizens. And I think that's partially, at least, a result of what you've just described. We have every issue's a national issue, and you fight to the death to get your position in national public policy because there's no alternative of, say, having 50 different answers to the question in your various states.
I want to come back to some of those issues that seem to be so centralized we can't solve them in a couple minutes. But first, I want to take just a slight detour. Well, maybe it's not really even a detour. A lot of Americans nowadays, when we come through, especially presidential elections, but sometimes other ones too, you hear a lot of grousing, honestly, Bill, by people who say, well, it's not fair that states like California get two senators. And a state like Wyoming, you know, it gets two senators. Wyoming only has 587,000 people. California, 37 million. California should have more senators. And of course, that's reflected then in the compositional formula for the Electoral College through which we elect our presidents. So we should amend the Constitution, they say, so as to eliminate this thing whereby each state has the same number of senators. So first question on that is, Bill, is it even possible to amend the Constitution to jack up the number of senators from California?
I think the best solution, if California wants more senators, is to divide in half.
There you go.
Northern and Southern. But no, that's a fundamental feature protected by the Constitution, the sovereignty of the states where they have equal representation in the Senate there. And again, if you view America as a unitary state, no different than Great Britain or France or Russia, what have you, then sure, it sounds like, oh, this is terrible that California is underrepresented. However, if you're a citizen of a federation, with right. independent states, it makes perfect sense that you should respect the state sovereignty and equality by the representation that we have in the United States Senate.
Article 5 is the article about amending the Constitution, and I'm just looking at it to remind myself here. As far as I can read this, this feature of the Constitution is the only part that is now unamendable, because it says that notwithstanding the provisions of amending, no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. That's a pretty hard stop, because you can't even amend that, according to the amendment article. So it's deeply entrenched. And the reason why, I think, goes back to the Constitutional Convention and the so-called Great Compromise. Can you remind us about that?
Sure. I mean, ever since Articles of Confederation, really, there has been a tension. The larger states have wanted representation in both houses of Congress, or the one house of Congress, whether it's unicameral or a bicameral, to be by population. Why? Because they have bigger populations. That would give them more power, whereas the smaller states have fought for the principle of equal representation as sovereign states in a league or a federation. So eventually we have some give and take to where we combine both ideas. You know, okay, Virginia, you've got a huge population. The House of Representatives is going to reflect that. However, New Hampshire is going to have equal weight in the Senate with the number of senators. So both principles are respected. What a great compromise.
It was a remarkable compromise. Well, I guess if you look at it in a certain way, back then, Virginia was kind of like the California of today in terms of having high population compared to other states. And they compromised. It was a pretty amazing compromise, really. And then that also then bears on the Electoral College, because the arithmetic for that adds up, you know, the number of senators plus the number of representatives. I mean, California still has the biggest electoral vote of any state. It's got 54 electoral votes, I think, and Wyoming only has 3 electoral votes. So poor little Wyoming is still kind of on the short end of the stick, but there's a kind of equalization among states because of the Senate being the way it is. Well, so what do you think about this national popular vote thing? You know what I'm talking about?
No, I think it's a terrible idea.
I agree with you.
I mean, it pushes us further away from a federal system. It teaches the citizens that we don't act in our states. And you think about it, the American people, to the extent there's such an entity, they do no act of constitutional significance. We elect representatives in districts in our states. We elect senators. Of course, they were appointed by the states before the Progressive Era amendments. But we do that in our states, choose our 2 senators. We elect a president via electors chosen in our states by the formula you mentioned earlier with the number of senators and representatives. It is a federal union, and we push away from that with a national popular vote. We forget who we are while we're special.
As I recall reading, the trick of the so-called national popular vote is that each individual state, because they're kind of stuck with that, but each individual state enacts a thing saying that they will elect, that they will assign all of their electoral votes to the winner of the so-called national popular vote. And so for some states, that would involve flipping the actual outcome of the vote in their state so that it would match the national, so-called national total. But I mean, is there even such a thing, Bill, as the national popular vote?
No,
for president?
I mean, there's absolutely not. Again, we don't act nationally as a people. I mean, we might think of ourselves on the 4th of July as the great American people, but really we're citizens of pre-existing political communities in our state, involved in a federation that we act together for certain important national matters, but otherwise we should govern our own affairs.
And in other respects, we don't act together because we have separate 50 separate states. And so when you say toward the beginning of your book, that sovereignty and political power ultimately comes from the people. What you don't mean by that is a mass aggregation of the population of, what are we at, 300 some million Americans. You're referring to what the people meant at the time of the establishment of the Constitution. Can you elucidate?
Sure, I'll be happy to. It's essentially the idea that we have 13 colonies, then they became states, and they were 13 separate, as I said, pre-existing political communities. They had 13 peoples there. There was one motion in the Federal Convention to have a National Ratification Convention. Wasn't even seconded.
Today it would just be passed, like everyone would say, oh yeah, that's fine.
Exactly. No one would bat an eye. But instead, as multiple delegates said, for this to go into effect, we need it to have the highest sanction possible. And that's the people of the several states acting in their constituent power in convention.
13 peoples, now 50 peoples. And the ratifying process, so fascinating when you go back and look at it, and you remind us of it in your book. It could have been done by a national plebiscite, so rejected, as you just told us. It could have been done by the legislatures of the 13 states. But instead, as in so many cases in this really pretty brilliant constitution, there was a complex balancing arrangement whereby instead of the state legislatures, there were specially called ratifying conventions in each state, right? And how did that work?
No, the framers rightly viewed a legislature as exercising ordinary powers, making ordinary law and statutes. They were not fit in American constitutional theory to enact fundamental law. The British Parliament couldn't, as a legislative body, could alter fundamental law. But we rejected that model with the Revolution. Therefore, we need the people to call a specially sanctioned body to exercise ultimate sovereignty, to delegate powers, to withhold powers. And in the case of the Constitution, maybe to redistribute some from their various state governments and their state constitutions to the federal government and the federal constitution. Only the people could do that, acting in their separate conventions.
Yeah, so those conventions are so critical to understanding the meaning of the constitutional document, right, Bill?
No, they're critical to understand the meaning of the constitutional document, to understand really, where does the most fundamental question in government is, where does ultimate authority lie? In America, the answer is the people, i.e., the people of the several states.
The several peoples.
Correct. And until we get that idea back in our heads, we have lost that. To the extent we think it's some national body, we really we rob ourselves of the idea of where power is and how it can be effectively utilized.
Yeah, it's just amazing. You and I are talking about stuff which is just pretty much plain understanding for many generations in the United States. Speaking of it as a plural noun. But now it's just like you and I are speaking like a foreign language when it comes to this kind of thing. So this is going to be tough work, but I think people need to read your book and see how you lay out these arguments. One of the things that you say explain at length, Bill, is the ways in which the constitutional provisions and structures and rules have kind of gotten twisted or gone wrong or been derailed. We have people with us. Quite a number actually are with us live on this broadcast. And so I'm getting questions from people. So one of our friends named Maria sent in this very basic question, which have been the main distortions of key constitutional provisions? So my stab would be, and then you can correct me and elaborate, my stab would be the way Commerce Clause has been misused, the way the General Welfare Clause has been misused, the way the Due Process Clause in the 14th Amendment has been used, and the way Equal Protection has been. Are those the four worst offenders, Bill, or what do you think?
It's hard not to give you an A-plus for that answer, Tim. That's great. No, you're absolutely right. I would answer that the foundation of the modern state is the Commerce Clause and the spending power and the general welfare provision. Obviously, commerce was understood as trade, traffic, and commodities. It's now been turned into something of national economic power or anything that can affect the national economy. What that essentially means is the federal government has a general police power to enact anything it sees fit for the health, welfare, morals of the people. The spending power. Now, obviously, Madison argued that Congress can only spend money pursuant to its enumerated powers. It has to point to an enumerated power before it can spend. Hamilton, Story, argued, well, no, it's not really tied to that. As long as there's a good national purpose, Congress can do so. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court settles the matter in the mid-1930s and sides with
Hamilton. So late in history.
No, not that long ago. They yeah. side with the Hamiltonians and essentially unleash this unlimited spending power. Now, there's a four-part test that the court has established, but it's pretty weak and doesn't stop much going through Congress. But yeah, those are the main provisions for the legislative body. You want to talk about the courts, then I think absolutely due process is the big ticket item. And of course, equal protection too, but we have to understand that at the time of the founding, at the time of the 14th Amendment as well, due process
1868.
Yeah, was understood as procedures in court that the government had to refer to pre-existing law if it was going to try to deprive a citizen of their life, liberty, or their property. It has become essentially a substantive matter where the courts now look at the substance of legislation to see if it's reasonable. Do they like it or not via substantive due process? And that is completely divorced from the original meaning, but it allows a court to be a roving constitutional convention, striking laws that they see as bad policy and upholding things they agree with. It's those provisions are the key to the modern state.
Key to the modern state, because the modern state's comprehensive claim to power is, at least in principle or theoretically, justified by this argument that, well, if there's a process, it has to be due. And of course, the term due is a wonderful word from moral philosophy going back way back into antiquity, but it essentially means, you know, perceived as being just. But if the whole constitutional document is just simply an elaboration of that one simple word, just, then why do we need the document? Just like, do what you feel like is just.
No, we could go back much further, but you know, Justinian obviously teaches that to give every man his due, that is the ultimate meaning of justice. Of course, Justinian also makes clear that you don't steal and transfer property from one person to another, as a lot of folks would do today. But no, due process had a clear legal meaning. Even Hamilton was very clear in his debates how circumscribed it was. But here
so
we
the notion of due-ness or of justness had a narrow and historical meaning, but it came to be an excuse for very wide-ranging, like, philosophizing from the bench by judges. They seemed to put on their cap of, you know, wonderful aspirational thoughts when they get to that word due. And it seems like you could justify anything that in their mind feels like due or just.
No, that's right. It just depends on what side of the political spectrum they are. We can go back in time and some of the justices that were very strong proponents of laissez-faire capitalism, which is a good thing, I think, as a policy, but they were writing that into law and striking down state statutes that were meant to protect workers. Again, you and I can say, well, those statutes weren't wise, but they certainly fell within the state's constitutional powers. Then as time marches on, you have these, we'll call them conservatives for lack of a better term, leave the bench and you have more progressives. So due process is applied to more personal liberty items, such as access to contraceptives, abortion, that type thing. But they're doing the same thing that they criticize the conservatives in the 1890s, early 1900s for doing. It's just they have a different set of values that they like and they're writing into law.
So, yeah, the famous case Lochner versus New York, I think, is what's coming to my mind when you talk about the old proponents of laissez-faire who wanted to basically use the word do to justify their sometimes very good preferences, but they weren't legally mandated preferences. The word due process turned out to be an excuse for exploration of your values or something like that as a judge. So we've covered...
And then ultimately you have, you know, Anthony Kennedy describing the liberty protected by the due process clause as essentially self-actualization and how every individual can determine the mystery of human life for themselves. And, you know, maybe that's a C on a freshman philosophy paper, but unfortunately it's a governing precedent of the Supreme Court.
You're quoting one of the abortion cases, as I recall, isn't that right? And who was speaking there about the so-called determining the mystery of human life for yourself?
Tony Kennedy.
Anthony Kennedy, appointed by Ronald Reagan?
President Reagan, absolutely.
Yeah. Wow.
A good California fellow.
A good Californian, yeah. Well, that passage, they refer to it as the mystery passage. Mm-hmm. But of course, it sounds good on a certain level, you know, when a jurist says, you know, people should be able to decide for themselves the mystery of the meaning of life, except that they weren't deciding for themselves. They were deciding whether certain entities, certain beings were human beings or not, and whether they were going to be subject to a coercive termination of their lives or not. There were big consequences. It wasn't just a personal thing. Those abortion cases had huge ramifications, it seems to me.
No, he certainly did. And, you know, Kennedy, again, some libertarians might cheer that. But if you get down to the constitutional text, you get down to original intent, that's just not a matter that was left for the federal government, especially the courts, to regulate. You know, the idea that the 14th Amendment was intended to empower the courts is absolutely crazy. Insofar as the radical Republicans, one of the big things they're chafing at when they come into power and seize power in the 1860s is obviously the Dred Scott decision of the Taney Court, which struck down essentially the Missouri Compromise and some other facets of it. But it was court power that they were somewhat rebelling against, and to think that they would hand such a power over to the courts rather than Congress is ludicrous, especially when you have Section 5 of the 14th Amendment that clearly indicates that Congress is the one that enforces the 14th Amendment. Not the courts certainly are going to have an auxiliary job there, but Congress is the main player.
So we've answered, I think, Maria's question, which was what are the worst distortions? Commerce Clause, we talked about that, general welfare by which Congress has seized authority to spend all sorts of money and all sorts of stuff that isn't specified, due process, which gives judges the feeling of freedom to rule pretty much on anything where their moral sentiments take them, equal protection. Everybody likes equal protection, don't they? How has Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment been derailed? Can you talk about that a little bit?
No, I like the idea of equal protection, and the way I would interpret that is very much like the first Justice Harlan, that you don't confer benefits or burdens on citizens based on, say, some immutable characteristic like race, sex, what have you, there, your national origin. But instead, we're all citizens and we should be treated alike under the law. That has sort of morphed over the years to allow for discrimination rather than to overturn discrimination. Liberals on the court argue that affirmative action and similar type measures for diversity are sanctioned by the Equal Protection Clause. So we discriminate.
Hard to believe that that's how this, I mean, explicitly you're favoring some and disfavoring others based on their race, and that's supposed to be protected, or was supposed to be protected, by the Equal Protection Clause.
No, absolutely.
What were they thinking?
They just, you know, essentially you've taken the Equal Protection Clause like a thing of wax. They've molded it for their vision of society. And rather than follow the clear intent, obviously the framers of the 14th Amendment, specifically they were thinking of the freedmen. They wanted the freedmen to have an equal shake under the law with whites in the United States, especially the southern states, where you had
absolutely
the problems at the time. But all of a sudden, if that would be transformed into a vehicle where you can pick a favored group or class and pass legislation to benefit them and burden another, that turns the world on its head from what we were trying to do.
Yeah, it certainly does. And of course, one of the most striking consequences of this modern view of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment was the Obergefell case, which struck down marriage laws all around the United States, which had been enacted by various states, and overruled them because it argued that the Equal Protection Clause protected marriage between man and men and women and women. Can you explain how the Equal Protection Clause was used in that way for that purpose? I mean, if you think about historically, the ratifiers of 1789 and of 1868 would hardly have imagined that the Constitution would mandate a change in the meaning of marriage.
No, absolutely. You can go to the beginning, obviously, and state domestic relations law was clearly a reserved matter of the states that they could legislate on, have different codes of laws. There's absolutely nothing in the debates on the 14th Amendment that would indicate there's been a change of view on that. You know, as the framers of the 14th Amendment still believed in states with vast powers. Now, granted, certain powers were given to the nation, they thought as needed, but it did not work this great this upheaval on simple matters of local state law. But here we have the Supreme Court, and it was a combination of due process and equal protection that essentially tell the states that, no, it's improper for you to have a traditional definition of marriage codified in your either fundamental law or statutory law. That has to go. It's divorced from the original intent of the Equal Protection Clause, which again focused on the freedmen. And if you take it to its logical extent, I mean, what classifications can you have? Remember, the courts said it's irrational, not irrational, to have.
Yeah, that was a stunning choice of words, wasn't it? That this idea that had been predominated in all parts of human history for all generations now suddenly was revealed as being irrational.
Again, that just is judicial, you know, hubris there, and its worst form, and that's what the Supreme Court has become.
So, of course, the various states now, because opinions have changed, probably a lot of the states, if they had the freedom to decide what marriage is for their states, would enact same-sex marriage statutes. But that's not what the Supreme Court set forth. They set forth a uniform national rule.
No, that's right. It's very similar to sort of the abortion decision, Roe versus Wade. The Supreme Court got in the way of the give and take of political debate, the political process, and created a one-size-fits-all rule. So the losers never felt like they had a fair playing field, that they could be heard, that they could offer their views in the public square and persuade the legislators or their fellow citizens. They had their legs cut out from under them. And that does not advance healing, reconciliation, or respect for the quote-unquote prevailing view when you feel like it was a corrupt bargain at the court.
So with abortion, the Dobbs case apparently restored to the states their prerogative of determining what abortion was legitimate and what illegitimate in their states. Could there be a Dobbs solution for same-sex marriage?
There could be. You know, Justice Thomas made pretty clear that this whole substantive due process needs to go, that the court is well beyond constitutional boundaries, and we need to rethink multiple facets of the court's jurisprudence, including same-sex marriage and other matters such as that. Others were trying to be very careful. Oh, we're just deciding this one discrete area. This has no bearing on other areas of law. Well, that's poppycock. It's just like Anthony Kennedy and the Lawrence decision, which found the constitutional right of homosexual sodomy, said, oh, no, this marriage? What's Scalia talking about in dissent? We're not saying anything about marriage here. Who said anything about marriage? But as Scalia pointed out, the principles obviously carry further, and they did, and as well Dobbs. Those principles could carry further if the court has the courage.
Could we have a kind of social peace on some of these controversial things by returning to our more fundamental constitutionalism? Could there be different states with different abortion laws, different states with different marriage laws? Could we agree to disagree and have our different jurisdictions so that the different peoples in the different states could exercise their sovereignty? Could that be possible again, Bill?
That was the founders' vision for the United States that existed for a very long time. I think it could happen again. Again, we have to first realize that we want the benefits of a federation, that we don't want to be at each other's throats, that what you do in California should not be an issue to me in South Carolina. You can govern yourself. If the policy experiments you undertake out there, if they work out well, we might want to copy them in South Carolina, but we ought not be forced to adopt them, nor should you be forced to adopt what we experiment with or we try here. If we did that, perhaps we wouldn't be at each other's throats all the time.
That's what I was thinking. Mm-hmm, exactly. But under these rulings, at least the ones we're talking about right now, it just seems like the whole country has to be California.
No, it's winner take all. It's
right.
It's, you know, a gladiators fighting in the arena. It's a sad situation.
It is. And you know what strikes me as odd about it is that in a lot of the 14th Amendment jurisprudence, it's about discovering or and announcing or protecting an individual right of some kind, a right to marry or a right to abort or a right to whatever. And we often think that individual rights are a great limitation on government power. But in many of these cases in the 20th century, it seems that the discovery of new rights by the court is the basis for vast expansion of the power of the central government. This is a paradox where individual rights become a leverage for the growth of central government power.
No, what is the greatest right of the American Revolution? I would argue it's the right for self-government, to self-government there. That was why the revolution was fought, that we would govern ourselves in our 13 different parliaments or legislatures rather than a centralized parliament in Westminster. That is the essence of the American Revolution. We essentially reject that legacy when we demand these national one-size-fits-all solutions. We have a nationalized discourse, and we don't govern ourselves in our local assemblies.
I can't leave the subject that we're on right now without asking another very maybe technical question, but pretty important. Does Article 6 preclude the kind of social peace solution that I was just celebrating a few moments ago, namely, let the states have their own marriage laws. But according to Article 6, the public acts of one state have to be accepted by other states. Is that a, how does that fit into this subject?
Well, that's
Article 4, rather.
Or what you're thinking of there is essentially this idea of judgments, records. For example, if you are a debtor and I'm a creditor and I get a judgment against you in California and you flee to, say, New York, I don't have to fully litigate the case again in New York if I locate you, but that judgment, it has preclusive effect there. Now, that's essentially the context for this. But if you look, you know, Congress can make regulations and exceptions. The court has recognized it has power given to it. DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, back in the 90s was
signed by Bill Clinton.
Yeah, by Bill Clinton was an example of that. But no, I think if you look at the original intent of the provision, there's plenty of room for the states to act and have their own laws.
So when it says here in Article 4, which I misstated before, when it says full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state, that doesn't mean that if one state has a definition of marriage, every other state has to accept their definition, because you say it's much narrower in its meaning.
It is narrower, and the courts for many years have recognized state public policy exceptions. For example, if someone in Massachusetts got married, a gay couple, and came to South Carolina, and that was against the public policy of South Carolina, the state wouldn't have to recognize that marriage. Now, they would still be legally married in Massachusetts, could inherit, et cetera, under that state's laws, but the public policy exception would preclude forcing South Carolina to change its laws in that situation.
So notwithstanding Article 4, it might be possible to have the kind of social peace, constitutionally allowed social peace, that we may need on some of these hot-button issues. That's kind of heartening, Bill.
No, that's hope out there, and that's one reason for writing this book, is there is hope. We don't have to continue like this. We don't have to be at each other's throats all the time. We don't have to have every issue decided by the United States Congress or the Supreme Court. We can have diversity of opinion. We can have the states can be laboratories of democracy, to quote Brandeis. They were intended to be. We can live together and undertake certain great national responsibilities, including defense, foreign trade, what have you, together. But we don't have to regulate each other's municipal law and fight over whether you can have a camping ordinance in a particular city, and that's a national law issue. It's crazy.
So one of our viewers sends in this question about Ron, his name, it says, can't we have a constitutional convention to fix things like term limits or undo the 16th and 17th Amendments?
That is an option. We certainly, if enough states petition, Congress would have to call a constitutional convention. I'm a little nervous about that, considering the population of the United States and as crazy as some areas of the United States to me seem, that the result would not be term limits or a balanced budget amendment, but would be a guaranteed universal basic income or something like that instead. So I'm a bit leery, though. Yeah, it's a possibility, but with our current political situation and the way our populace seems to lean, I'm a little scared of that.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I do acknowledge that ultimately sovereignty and all power comes from the people, or the 50 peoples, but some of the peoples are kind of maybe not all that trustworthy. But if they did it, if we had the requisite number of states calling for a convention, it would go ahead, and it should, legally speaking, right?
It should, but you know, what could it be controlled? I mean, that's the big question.
Right. If
say it was, the impetus was a balanced budget amendment, could a convention be limited to considering a balanced budget amendment? We don't have any precedent. It's a good
point. Don't have precedent. That's right.
Yeah. And if it's sovereign power being exercised, how do you control ultimate sovereignty? Problem.
Well, let's talk a little bit more philosophically here toward the end of this conversation. We've been talking about some nuts and bolts, and you've given me reason for hope on a number of scores, which I appreciate. You say in your book that there are kind of three basic ways of interpreting the Constitution, three basic interpretive outlooks. One you call Jeffersonian's strict construction originalism, which is what you favor. And then there's 1980s modern originalism. And then there's living constitutionalism. And then you subdivide living constitutionalism in both its two right-wing and left-wing versions. So you really lay out a nice tableau explaining to us how these outlooks work when it comes to interpreting the text. Can you unpack a little bit, though, the distinction between Jeffersonian strict construction originalism and 1980s or whatever modern originalism? They're both originalisms. You seem to be a little hard on your fellow originalists who are more modern.
Everyone claims to be an originalist now. Elena Kagan, in her confirmation hearing, said, we're all originalists now, just like I think if it was Nixon, said, we're all Keynesians now with economics. If we're all originalists, then what are we really? Originalism has been tortured in the academy and in multiple research papers, where we've gotten away from the real originalists, the Madisons, the Jeffersons, the John Taylors, the St. George Tuckers, who set forth the principles, simple principles, that if there's a question of what the Constitution means, we should carry ourselves back to the spirit of the debates, what was said, what was represented, and govern ourselves accordingly. Instead, originalism now has become an exercise, the apocryphal story of the scholastic scholars arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. That's really what our modern academics are doing with originalism, and it's not aimed at trying to control government power, which was what the originalists sought to do, i.e. hold the Federalists, the Hamiltonians, to the representations they made in the state ratifying conventions, in the Federalist Papers, what have you. But now it's just a free-for-all to... You find more angels that you can put on the needle, and you have these crazy results, such as, Gorsuch would say he's an originalist and a textualist, but you look at some of his decisions, especially with civil rights legislation, where on one hand, he admits that in Bostick that no one really in the 1960s would have understood, when you're talking about sex, any transgender element to this. Nobody knew what that was. But then he applies it that way and claims he's a good originalist. It sounds like the greenhouse effect to me. He wants the parades of the New York Times rather than to control government power. On the right, with the living constitutionalist, you have some that don't even play it, the originalist game. But hey,
maybe they're more honest.
I think they are. That we need to just update the Constitution as we see fit, as time goes on. Forget about Article 5 and the amendment procedure. That's why we have these wise Harvard and Yale graduates on the Supreme Court, is to figure these things out. They're the experts. Let's let them do that and expand government power. And we've lost the whole purpose of the originalism that Madison and Jefferson argued for, to limit federal authority to the confines of the Constitution as represented in the ratification debates.
You quoted St. George Tucker and, I guess, Thomas Jefferson in your first chapter. or your introduction, which pointed out that strict construction is defined by an attempt to limit federal power, a strict, narrow construction of federal power where it could otherwise impinge on the rights of states or of the people. So the animating principle of your original strict construction originalism is the animating motive is restriction of power.
Unapologetically, that is the aim. That was the original goal of originalism. Again, not Federalist Society originalism or whatever, Elena Kagan originalism, but the real theory put forward by the men who were part of the debates, who participated in the process, often helped frame the instrument, that originalism, what was represented, what was promised, let's hold to those promises. That's all I'm advocating for, asking here.
So by contrast, with you've got the right word, living constitutionalism, by people like Adrian Vermeule of Harvard, whose theory of common good constitutionalism basically says that we need to use the power of the courts and the central government to promote and advance our conservative vision of federal police power, because we conservatives got the morality right, so we got to use the power to push it. Whereas Cass Sunstein, I think, is an example of more left-leaning living constitutionalism. We need to embody in the laws and in court judgments our advanced progressive moral aspirations, which we know are better than those conservative aspirations. But either way, they just want to use the power of the central state to push their moral vision. Is that basically what distinguishes right from left living constitutionalism?
That's a very fair summary. It's just, Adrian, Cass, they would push a little bit different in certain directions, but they want to marshal the power of the center to impose what they see as the good on the entire nation. They reject federalism. They reject this idea that you can have 50 different answers to a particular question, or even two different answers.
Mm-hmm.
Their one answer, they want to use national power to promote, and they sweep away any constitutional restraint.
Oh, but think of all the good that could be done if we just went with it and didn't worry about these limitations on power. We could just get there. We could go to nirvana. We could go to utopia right away, Bill.
That's right. We could make one of us king and just think of all the good things we could do.
Oh, man.
Yes, like, that would be scary.
Yes, spare us from ourselves, huh? So, but then to go back just one step, the modern originalism is not as good as the strict construction originalism, because modern originalism seems always to be coming up with clever ways to justify new federal power. Is that right?
No, you look at Akil Amar is the classic example. As much as I do love the Federalist Society, they do great things, but you will find him, for example, he's on the marquee if there's a big conference, and he gets standing ovations from these conservatives who apparently haven't really read his books and see that he has a vision of the Commerce Clause that would encompass everything, civil rights.
Everything.
Economic legislation, civil rights legislation, has nothing to do with the original intent, as, you know, for example, as Justice Thomas nicely laid out in his concurring opinion in Lopez, for example. But he's a main player in this, and all his efforts are is to expand government power and to have a more nationalized political discourse. And that passes for originalism? I dissent on that. No.
I would just add one slight caveat for him, for Amar. I've read some of his earlier stuff on Establishment Clause jurisprudence, and he seems to be a lot better than his fellow progressives on that particular point, seeming to recognize that the constitutional position on establishment of religion is that the states had wide power to decide whether and what to what degree to have religious establishments. That was good, wasn't it?
No, he's not bad on free speech. I mean, in fact, you will see him on occasion has stood up to campus radicals on the left.
Right. Credit where credit is due.
Yep. So I will definitely give him credit there for that.
But we want to make sure we don't get confused by what seems like originalism, but really tends to push in almost every case to justify expansion of central government powers. That's your point, right, Bill?
No, that's unabashedly my point is, I think Rahul Berger and Robert Bork, though now they're sort of dismissed, oh, they were proto-originalists. They didn't see, you know, they're talking about original intent of the framers, where we're now to this original, you know, public meaning and looking at the text, and that's so far superior than what they devised. No, they were much closer to Jefferson and Madison and the original originalism, the Jeffersonian strict construction originalism, as I call it in my book, but now they reject it as just simpletons, as we have far more advanced theory, an advanced theory that really pushes government power further. It's not too advanced to me.
Yeah, well, especially Robert Bork, he knew what he was talking about. He saw some of these issues. And in his view, and some of these others that you admire, what I see kind of as an underlying foundation is a very realistic view of human nature. And you mentioned this, I think, at some points in your book. The Federalist Papers point out that men are not angels, and we need to control the bad impulses of human nature, which are inevitable. But precisely because the bad impulses are inevitable, you got to find a way to limit the power of the controllers, because human nature is what it is. There's nobody who can be counted on to be just as pure and powerful as possible. No way.
Nope. The framers understood that, and your summary there could be straight out of Calhoun's Disquisition on Government, as he understood human nature very well, therefore, he comes up with his theory of the concurrent majority as a check. But yeah, it's if men were angels, we would need no government.
I am so grateful to Bill Watkins for writing this great book, The Independent Guide to the Constitution, which I'm just showing you again here what the cover looks like, encouraging our friends to go to our website, independent.org, and you can order the book there or from your favorite booksellers elsewhere at the same time. You've done quite a service, Bill, and I think a lot of ordinary people may be able to look into this book that you've written and see that the Constitution belongs to them after all, and maybe they'll do something about it.
Amen and amen. If they would look at that, look at the book, use it as a resource, read it all the way through, look at certain provisions you're interested in, look at the footnotes, go from there and dig deeper. This is your Constitution, and I hope to give it back to the people.
Exactly. You don't have to be a lawyer to understand this thing.
No, it would actually help if you're not.
Okay. There you go. Okay. Thanks so much to William Watkins, Jr. Thanks to our friends for joining us on Independent Conversations. Please come back and visit us again. We're grateful to have you all with us. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Graham.
Okay. Take care, everybody. Bye.